Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, South Bay Live Music, on March 20th, 2018. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here in the South Bay of Los Angeles, and it's also a place, a beautiful place, to listen to live music. This show is brought to you by Masternode, a cryptocurrency company. Masternode Consulting, a cryptocurrency company. The world of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency today is very scary and new, and yet many people view it as the future and would like to invest safely and wisely. You can buy digital coins and hold them, or HODL, H-O-D-L, as it's called. Or you could participate in an ICO, an initial coin offering, but many of those are ill-conceived, and picking and choosing those that make sense and those that don't is difficult. Then there is the world of masternodes, where without the expense of traditional proof-of-work mining, you can have the blockchain pay you directly whenever new coins are minted. We believe this is the best possible way to prosper in the blockchain, and for more information, visit their website at www.masternodeconsulting.com. That's M-A-S-T-E-R-N-O-D-E consulting, all one word, masternodeconsulting.com, or call 310-379-9822. Today, we welcome the Beach City Symphony music director, Barry Brisk. Barry Brisk first conducted the in public at the age of 14 when he performed selections from South Pacific at his graduation from Webster Junior High School in West Los Angeles. As a student, he also conducted the orchestras at University High School, Mount St. Mary's College, and the University of Music, formerly Academy of Music, in Vienna, Austria, where he studied with the prominent director or conductor teacher Hans Swarovski. Professionally, Brisk has conducted many orchestras in Southern California, as well as in Mexico and Austria. Maestro Brisk has been music director of the Beach City Symphony since 1994 and is particularly proud of having expanded the orchestra's repertoire. Barry Brisk will have a pre-concert lecture at 7:15 p.m. The concert is free. Parking is $3. Please bring three $1 bills to make it easy to use the parking kiosks. Today, we're talking about love and poetry. And welcome, Barry. Welcome to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, this is a very interesting lineup of music. As I was going through the music for the show today, I loved everything about the music. And, of course, we have two appearances in our we're gonna play some of the music of Seiji Ozawa conducting a piece by Maurice Ravel, and then a piece by Franz Liszt. He is the conductor on these pieces that we're going to be playing. But these are really, really loved pieces. How did this come about, this particular slate of music, love and poetry?
To be honest, since I did this over a year ago, coming up with all that, I wanted to do the Ravel, the Daphnis and Chloe second suite. We did it in 2001. Yeah. It's rather challenging for a community orchestra to play this. There's, you know, millions of notes, whatnot, and also it requires a number of extra instruments. You have to have an E-flat clarinet and a bass clarinet and a contrabassoon and two harps and four trumpets instead of two, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So you have to arrange for these instruments to happen. And as I said, there's, you know, notes all over the place. So it's almost frightening. And we do it. As I said, we've done it before. Very few community orchestras play this because, one, it's difficult, and two, you have to have all these other arrangements to get all these extra people, and we happen to play on a very large stage in Marcy Auditorium at El Camino College, so there's no problem setting up two harps and, you know, things of that nature. They take up a lot of space. So I had that, and then I was in discussion with Stephen Van Howard, our pianist, and I suggested the Liszt Second Concerto, and he said, "Oh, I love that piece." So we're doing the Liszt Second Concerto, and I needed a little more time after the intermission. The Ravel, as wonderful as it is, is not as big as a symphony. It's not that long, so I needed something else. So after discussion with our concertmaster, Rebecca Rutkowski, we chose to do Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending, which is for violin solo with a smaller orchestra. And it's a very lovely, gentle, pastoral, very English kind of a piece. And so that makes a lovely, right, it comes right after intermission, it makes a lovely contrast to the upcoming Ravel, which is a very beautiful piece, but is very dynamic and colorful, and, you know, with this huge orchestra. Mm-hmm. And this is a gentle little thing before it.
Right.
Of course,
right.
It's also, this is Leonard Bernstein's 100th anniversary. He was born in 1918, so it's appropriate to do the Candide Overture. Most of his stuff is too difficult for community orchestras, and they're huge pieces, his various symphonies and whatnot. So most of us at this level of orchestra are doing that overture, which is a marvelous little 5-minute piece, which is utterly delightful.
Yes.
So that's how we came up with that program.
It is a wonderful program. It is so. I was listening to the pieces, I realized how much I had loved them, and I was not familiar with the Vaughan Williams Lark Ascending piece. I really wasn't familiar with that piece. The Liszt Piano Concerto No. 2 I had heard before. I guess I certainly had heard Candide Overture before by Leonard Bernstein. I had heard it, but these pieces are beautiful. Well, without further ado, I think we should play one of the pieces.
Very good.
Which one would you like to play first?
Why don't we start with the Liszt?
Okay, let's do that. And it is so surprising. We'll talk about it after I play a little bit of it. And as I said, this piece was conducted by Seiji Ozawa. It's actually a recording of Zimmerman at the piano.
Who is at the piano?
Zimmerman.
Oh, okay. All right. Christian Zimmerman. Yes. Right,
yes,
Polish
indeed.
Pianist.
Yes. Zimmerman.
Now, the interesting thing about... go ahead.
Yes.
Okay,
no,
the interesting
please.
Thing about Ozawa, you know, for many years, like 29 years, he was the music director of the Boston Symphony. But when he was very young, he had studied with Leonard Bernstein. And so we're also doing a Leonard Bernstein piece on the program. So we have a bit of a connection there.
Yes. Well, here we go. I love this piece. Franz Liszt, Piano Concerto No. 2.
Thank you.
exciting piece.
Oh, definitely exciting, yes.
So is there anything that you can hear in this piece, Barry, that you would say, oh, yes, that's Seiji Ozawa, or yes, that's Christian Zimmerman? What are you listening for in terms of the performance by the pianist or the performance by the conductor?
Oh, I don't think of it in those terms. I think of it in how well or they're doing it. Of course, those kinds of people don't make mistakes. They do everything extremely well and very musical. From listening to it, I could not have picked either one of them. It's very difficult to say. I mean, you know, we used to think when there were fewer orchestras and fewer conductors that, well, that's Toscanini or that's Bruno Walter. But these days, there are so many things going on, it's really hard to be able to pick them out, particularly in a concerto where there's a blend of things and people have to work together. In other words, if a year later Ozawa had a different pianist who did things a little bit differently, he would have to do things a little bit differently. So when it comes to concertos, you can't always pick out who is conducting it, you know. I mean, they do it very well, but that's really a very tricky situation.
Yes, yes. Well, we get together on a regular basis every quarter and have this show about the Beach City Symphony Orchestra, which I'm really very, very glad to be a part of and to be the host of this show, because my wife and I love the Beach City Symphony Orchestra. And so I think it's time now to introduce the Beach City Symphony Orchestra to anyone who might happen across or stumble across this show and wonder, what is this? Give us a little history of the Beach City Symphony.
Well, it was started in 1949, which means it's 68 years old. We're in a 68th season right now. And there, by the way, there is one person, Bob Peterson, who was at the first rehearsal, and he's still playing with us at the age of 96. And he can still do it, by the way. It's in some ways, a typical community orchestra, which means it's made up mainly of community people, that is, non-professionals, who have people who, you know, live in the area, who have day jobs. And being in the South Bay, many of them are scientific day jobs in the, you know, the aerospace industry and whatnot. But we also occasionally have school teachers or doctors or something of that nature. And we do four concerts a year, usually one in the fall, like early November, one in mid-January, one in mid-March, and then one towards the end of May. And, of course, we do bring in a few professionals. I mean, our concertmaster, who's always there, Rebecca Rutkowski, is professional. We bring in a professional cellist, and then sometimes you need some other person, like a harp player, so we hire them to fill things out as needed. So we've been doing, you know, four concerts a year for 68 years. I'll let you do the calculation on how many of concerts that turns out to be, but it's hundreds. You know, so we've been there for a long time. We've been in El Camino Calamarcy Auditorium since that auditorium opened something like 53 years ago. I've forgotten the exact thing. We've been the only non-college organization who has been there continuously since they opened the hall, which is a little bit of a feather in our cap. Yes, and that more, and of course, like all orchestras, both small and large, we have a board of directors, you know, who we have to, there are all kinds of financial considerations that, you know, things you have to not just simply pay for or taxes or, you know, have a budget because you're bringing in a few professionals now and then. but you know, the other kinds of things you have to do. Oh, for instance, the Vaughan Williams piece we're playing, that is under copyright protection, so that has to be rented from the publisher, who is an English publisher, but they have a representative in New York, so we have to have money to rent that sort of thing. These, you know, rental items come up every so often. And so there are, you know, various things that a board of directors has to be prepared to handle. So, and of course, if you're a nonprofit organization in the state of California, in order to, you know, you have to have a board of directors in order to be a nonprofit. So there's all kinds of little things that you have to get into that are outside of the music itself. Everybody thinks the music, an orchestra, you know, you just do music, but no, there's a board of directors that does things that we have to do. We have fundraising activities, et cetera. And we go after memberships, people in the audience, or other people, you know, can send contributions in, and that has to all be accounted for, and it has to be arranged to be done, et cetera. So there's lots of things that an orchestra at this level has to take care of besides playing the music.
Yeah. Right, right. Wow, it's a huge undertaking. Four concerts a year, 68 years. It's 272 performances.
I'll take your word for that. Yes.
Thank you, Bob Peterson.
Sure.
Thank you, Bob Peterson.
Oh, yes.
200.
Yes. And I think that at this point, this is now my 23rd year, I think I'm the longest serving music director in the orchestra's history.
Yes. Yes.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
It's an amazing amenity for people to have. The concerts are free. The parking is very inexpensive. It's $3. If you have three $1 bills, it's very easy to operate the parking kiosks. For parking. You have a pre-concert lecture at 7:15 p.m. coming up this Friday.
Right.
And the concert begins at 8. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
Okay. These are things that I think a lot of people, you know, who are moving into the South Bay may not know. Even people that have lived there potentially their whole lives may not know.
Right.
And,
well,
and
publicity
just
is a difficult thing. You know, if you're talking about one of the world's great orchestras, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, they have a huge budget. And so you can, at least where I live in the San Fernando Valley, there are areas where you can see on Ventura Boulevards, there will be these like flags put up, you know, advertising their season with a picture of Dudamel on them and all that. But at our level, we can't afford anything like that, you know. So getting the word out is a very difficult thing. Also, it used to be 25 years ago, you know, if you bought an ad in the newspaper, a lot of people would see that. But today, not that many people read newspapers anymore. And of course, we put this up on Facebook, but of course, how many people from that area are on your Facebook list? You know, my personal Facebook list has people in Europe as well, you know, or all around the country, and of course, some people from the South Bay area, but it's still difficult to get the word out.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That's very true. Very true. So now we've talked a little bit about the orchestra, which I love doing. I want every show, I want to introduce new people to the orchestra. We want you to come, so please do come this coming Friday, March 23rd, at the Marseille Auditorium at El Camino College. You will have the opportunity to experience what it's like to have a community orchestra. So one of the other pieces. Now, what would be the next piece that we would preview for people?
Oh, why don't we do the Candide Overture by Bernstein? That's such a jolly, quick little thing. It's only 5 minutes long. So why don't we have a go
with
that?
Tell me. Let's have a go at that. But tell me a little bit about this. I mean, it's Leonard Bernstein's 100th birthday or 100th. he would be 100 this year in 2018.
Right. I forgot what month his birthday is in, but yes, he's 100 this year. Right. Well,
yeah.
This was composed in 1956. It's based on the Voltaire story, of course, but it was written, the libretto was written by Lillian Hellman, who was a big literary person at that time in New York. And she sort of made it a little bit pompous, and it wasn't quite the comic operetta that Bernstein had hoped for, and so it was not a success. It had something like 73 performances, which in Broadway terms is not a whole lot because you're playing every night.
Right.
And then they rewrote the story, and it came out again years later, and then it was a success. The music is all very delightful, but as a show, it just didn't make it at the beginning. There's one song in it, by the way, called I Am Easily Assimilated, and the lyrics to that were done by Leonard Bernstein and his wife Felicia. So that was kind of interesting. The original premiere was conducted by somebody named Samuel Krashmalnik, which I'm sure nobody has heard of who's listening to this. But Sam finished his career some 25 years later as the director of the orchestra at UCLA. So we had him here locally for a while. Yes. But the overture, which is very exciting and just utterly delightful, includes snippets from the aria Glitter and Be Gay, which is has become a very popular aria for, you know, coloratura sopranos and whatnot. But it's just a joyful thing, the way Bernstein was with his joyful, ebullient personality.
Wow. Give me a sense, just for those people who aren't familiar with classical music in general, but really want to know more, and we want to bring more people into the fold. What would you say, from a cultural perspective, what was the impact of Leonard Bernstein?
Oh, that was enormous, because not only was he an extraordinarily talented musician, and he was a brilliant conductor, he, amongst many things, he was conductor of the New York Philharmonic for 11 years. He conducted the Vienna Opera, Munich Opera, and he conducted all around the world. And he was, in 1960, which was the 100th anniversary of Gustav Mahler. Mahler wasn't nearly as popular back then as he is today, and that's mainly because Bernstein loved his music and performed it all the time and recorded it, and he really was the one who helped put Mahler on the map. Now his music is done all the time. And then, of course, there were his own compositions. From the 1940s, his ballets and things like that, Fancy Free and whatnot, are still very popular. Of course, they're being done a lot this year because it's his anniversary. But those things have always stayed in the repertoire. His big symphonies, things like The Age of Anxiety and Kaddish and... He has a third one, the title of which eludes me at the moment. They're really fine pieces of music. And then, of course, there was his educational things. Now, if you're as old as I am, you remember his concerts, his 45-minute or one-hour concerts for children with the New York Philharmonic, which were done live on television back in the 1950s. These are available nowadays on DVD, but they're just marvelous things. Now, when I say they were for children, we're not talking about elementary school children. We're talking about high school people. Just the way he expressed himself and his enthusiasm is everywhere, but just the way he could explain things, things that were technical, but he could explain them so that people who were not musicians could grasp what was going on and why the composer did this and that. As an educator, he was enormously talented and gave a great deal, which is the big thing about him was he gave everybody things, whether it's as a composer, as a conductor, as an educator. It was just a constant giving. And of course, he, like everybody who's that famous and brilliant, has a huge, had a huge personality, but he was, it wasn't
right.
like some other people whom I will not mention, who, you know, sort of kept it to themselves, and they just got out there and performed, and you applaud them. You know, he was giving all the time.
If you go to one of the my favorite places for exploring the careers of personalities is at IMDb. It's not just about film. If you type in Leonard Bernstein, you will get many film credits of various kinds. But he was a writer. He was an actor. He actually apparently acted in. He has 4 acting credits. Candide, which was a TV movie. The Schumann Symphonies, a TV miniseries, New York Philharmonic Young People's Concerts.
Well, yeah, but that's
Omnibus,
where he's talking to the audience. He's not an actor in that sense. He's the teacher, you know. Yes, and by the way, as for film credits, in 1952, I think it was, he wrote the music for On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, and he got an Academy Award for that music. However, he didn't care about the Oscars, and he did not attend the awards because at that exact time he was conducting the famous soprano Maria Callas at an opera in La Scala in Italy. So he didn't even come to pick up the award. He was busy going on to the next thing.
Excellent. Okay. Well, it's an Oscar, though. I mean, it is kind of important.
But he chose to do something else. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's a great bit of classical music trivia. Leonard Bernstein winning an Oscar, and you know exactly why he wasn't there.
Oh, yes. Everybody does. Yes.
Of course. Well, all right. Now we've got some more music. Let's talk about going to
play. We haven't
heard
Candide yet.
Candide. That's right.
The overture.
Leonard Bernstein.
Stein. Right.
The overture.
So,
Candide.
Right.
Here
that would
go.
Be a good.
Thank you.
Right.
Here we go.
Thank you. guess the audience really enjoyed it. That was good.
Yes.
Fun.
Do you know who the conductor was on that?
No, I don't.
Okay, doesn't matter.
And that was not even 5 minutes, so that was quite peppy.
Yes. Now, an interesting thing about Candide, it was, as I said, written to be like a comic operetta, which is close to a musical comedy. And those things have to get written rather quickly because of when the show is going to start, and you know there are various constraints on it. So doing an orchestration for something, you know, is a two-hour piece is a great deal of work, and it's very time-consuming. So frequently, musical comedies are orchestrated by someone else. You know, the composer composes it, basically, you know, what we would call a short score, either either like piano music or just a couple of lines, and then somebody else does the orchestration. But in this case, somebody else did the orchestration, but he insisted on orchestrating the overture himself. So it's typical Bernstein, mm-hmm. you know, light, bubbly, mm-hmm. ebullient, and all that sort of thing.
Wow. Yeah. It's there is something joyous about it, and I guess that's partly the choice of instrumentation, and yeah, it's really bouncy.
Well, it's also
the
story is very bubbly story, you know, so that's what it's reflecting.
Well, exciting pieces all. Is there any news, anything going on with the orchestra that we haven't talked about, Barry? New things happening, personnel changes,
no,
anything like that?
We don't usually have new things happening. It's just every year our four concerts. So, I mean, I'm not going to tell you about the May concert at this point. We'll wait till we get to May and we'll discuss that.
Right.
But not really. You know, it's just a big enough effort putting on the four concerts every year.
Okay. Well, we have two pieces remaining to feature, and what piece would you like? Which of these two would you like to feature next?
Oh, let's do the Von Williams Lark Ascending.
Okay, and we have the concertmaster Rebecca Rutowski is going to be the soloist.
That's correct.
How long has she been with the orchestra? How long has she been with the orchestra?
Well, she's been there longer than I have. She's been there like 26, 27 years as concertmaster. So she's a huge part of the orchestra. She's also the personnel manager. So she has various things, you know, various chores to take care of there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the Von Williams piece is rather interesting. He did his first draft of this in 1914, by the way. It's based on some poetry. And then, of course, he got involved in the First World War, being an Englishman. And he didn't come back to it till after the war. So in 1919, when the war was over, he had left several pieces unfinished, and this was the first one that he got around to taking care of, shall we say. It was written for a violinist, Marie Hall, who first played it with a piano accompaniment, and then later on she played it, shall we say, in the concertmaster's chair. What's different is usually if you get a violin soloist, they're standing up in front of the orchestra. That's what you would do with a concerto. Right. This is not a concerto. This is a small little piece. It's maybe 13 minutes long. But the concertmaster plays it from the concertmaster's desk, that is, sitting there in their position. Admittedly, when you get very prominent solo violinists like Pinchas Zukerman or Hilary Hahn, they do it standing up because they're not concertmasters, they're soloists. But when you have a soloist play it, they usually do it sitting down from their concertmaster's chair. Now, this is based on poems by George Meredith, Englishman, who lived between 1829 and 1909. So I'm just going to read this. It's about 12 lines long. Remember, the title mm-hmm. is The Lark Ascending. He rises and begins to round. He drops the silver chain of sound. Of many links without a break, in chirrup, whistle, slur, and shake. For singing till his heaven fills, 'tis love of earth that he instills. And ever winging up and up, our valley is his golden cup. And he the wine which overflows to lift us with him as he goes. Till lost on his aerial rings in light, and then the fancy sings. So that's the poem it's based on. I think that's actually a section of the poem. Now, there's a little comment about that, that at the time that this piece was written, the sound of the lark in the clear air was a feature of the summer landscape. Now, a century later, with the decline of the bird's population and the destruction of much of its habitat, it is a rarer joy. Perhaps the increasing popularity of the work is symbolic of a nostalgia for an England which is vanishing. So this was, of course, the poem was written when England was at its height. You know, England ruled Britannia, Britannia ruled the waves, and all that kind of thing. So they were very, so utterly proud, as they should have been, of England and English countryside. And, of course, like everywhere in the world, countryside is disappearing and becoming paved over. You know, so there's a little bit of nostalgia in this piece. It's a very charming thing, based to a great extent on modal scales, has the violin in a very high register, you know, because it's a bird flying up and away. So it's a very poetic, gentle piece. The other pieces on a concert are not gentle. Candide is definitely not gentle. The Liszt is not gentle. The Ravel has some gentle parts, but then at the end, when it has the big dance, that's anything but general. You want to get up and dance along with it. This is the complete opposite. It's just a pastoral piece which just flows along. And even the parts that are a little bit faster, not really fast, they just sort of move you up a little bit, and then it recedes back down to be like the gentle beginning. So this completely contrasts the other three pieces on the program, which is another thing that makes it interesting, of course.
Right. Fantastic. Well, with that, let's play a bit of The Lark Ascending by Ralph Vaughan Williams. Beautiful piece.
Oh, yes, it's lovely.
Looking forward to that. Looking forward to that.
Something I haven't I've neglected to mention. Of course, we talked about Rebecca Rutkowski being the violin soloist here. I briefly mentioned Stephen Van Howard being the soloist, the piano soloist in the Liszt concerto. But I forgot to mention about the Candide Overture. We're going to have a guest conductor in February. I missed a few rehearsals, so we didn't cancel rehearsals. I had a friend of mine, Mike Stanley, come and sub for me, and he did such an excellent job that I've offered to let him conduct the Candide Overture on the concert. So the first piece on the concert, after the Star Spangled Banner, will be conducted by Mike Stanley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. The first time that's happened since I've been music director, but he deserved it, you know, so I'm letting him do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure how I feel about that, Barry. I don't know. Another conductor on the dais.
You're supposed to look forward to it. I'm giving someone else a chance
okay.
to accomplish something.
Okay. All right. I'll look forward to it. That's wonderful. Now we have just left. We have the Maurice Ravel piece, Daphne and Chloe. Tell us a little bit about this.
It's pronounced. Excuse me. Since it's Greek, it's pronounced Daphnis. We do say the last N. It's Daphnis and Chloe.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh. Tell us about this piece.
Well, it's a ballet, a rather long thing. This was the largest orchestra piece that Ravel had ever written, and it tells the very pleasant sort of love kind of story about Daphne and Chloe. It's all in a very pastoral setting in woods and whatnot, and, you know, shepherds and sheep and nymphs dancing around and whatnot. He started working on this in 1909. It was commissioned by Serge Diaghilev. Diaghilev was in charge of the famous Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet, which performed in Paris from, let's say, 1905 to 1920 or into the 20s. They put on these wonderful productions of things, basically usually Russian things. Like last season, you may remember, we did the Firebird Suite of Stravinsky. Well, that was another Diaghilev commission. The very famous Rite of Spring by Stravinsky was a Diaghilev commission. And even Debussy's Prelude for the Afternoon of a Faun, they all received their premieres by the Ballet Russe in Paris. And so that's what this was written for. And it was put on on June 8th in 1912. It was conducted by who became very famous, the French conductor Pierre Monteur. And choreography was by Michael Fokine. And the famous Vasily Nijinsky was the Daphnis in it. Chloe was Tamara Karasavina. Now, these names are amazingly all forgotten today, but at the time, they were enormous people in their fields, those dancers. Nijinsky is still remembered vividly. There have been films made about him and many books written. But all of those people were the top professionals in the French world at that time. This music is very passionate. Sometimes Ravel, whose music always sounds wonderful, is a little on the cool side, because we have to remember, at the time he's composing, the Romantic era is past us, you know, and in the Romantic era, emotion was the big thing. So now we've come to a cooler era. Also, this is French, not German and Russian, with all their bombastic emotions. So this is a much cooler kind of a thing. But this piece I don't know how to describe it. It is utterly delightful. It is, the music is lush. It is extremely colorful. I mentioned earlier all the extra instruments that it uses. It evokes what it's supposed to evoke, although we're only doing the second suite, which we're doing is basically the last 16 minutes of the ballet. It has a number of different elements to it with different colors. And the beginning, the first, it's in three parts. The first part is called Daybreak, Lever du Jour. And basically, it's all very quiet at the beginning. You know, it's still dark outside. And you hear a few little birds chirping, and then gradually you feel the sun rising, and then at some point the sun rises, and then it's up full, and the crescendo, that is the gradually growing sound of the orchestra, it is the most sensuous thing that was ever composed up to the point where the sun is there. The way it just opens up is one of the most incredible things ever composed. It's not loud and dynamic. It's just awe-inspiring. It's really a marvelous sensation. The second part of the piece is called the pantomime, where various dancers do things. And, of course, we have no dancers, but you can hear an enormous flute solo. There's a solo for an alto flute, which is an extra flute player. And, you know, lots of things happen. There's a piccolo solo and an E-flat clarinet, which is a very high clarinet, which have solos representing shepherds with their flocks going through. And then the third section is the general dance, danse générale, in which sort of it starts out, I wouldn't exactly say modestly, but it starts out a little more quietly, and gradually it goes up and down and up and down in volume. But then finally when it bursts out and the whole thing is going, it's just an utterly glorious thing that is one of the unique things that Ravel did. And most of this dance is in 5-4 time. 1-2-3-4-5. 1-2-3-4-5. Which is gives it a special feel and flavor that you would not get in a Tchaikovsky ballet or something of that nature. Which is an utterly splendid piece.
Wow. Love it. Love it. Let's hear a bit of it before we go. Maurice Ravel, Daphnis and Chloe, suite number 2. Beautiful, beautiful beginning. Barry Brisk, thank you for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure, Joe.
And ladies and gentlemen, you will have an opportunity to hear this piece among the others that we've played this coming Friday, March 23rd, at the Marseille Auditorium at El Camino College. Concert begins at 8 p.m. Please arrive early, and you can attend Maestro Barry Brisk's pre-concert lecture at 7:15. Parking is $3. It's really convenient to bring three $1 bills, which makes it easy to operate the parking kiosks. And the concert itself is free. We hope to see you there, and bring all your friends and your neighbors. It's going to be a wonderful evening, and we hope to see you all there. Thank you very much, Barry. With that, we will see you on Friday.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right. That's our show, ladies and gentlemen. We wish you beautiful music, live music, right here in the South Bay, our own community symphony orchestra, the Beach City Symphony Orchestra. And you can find out more about them, Cities Symphony. Is that, I forget now, is that, oh, yes, beachcitysymphony.org, Beach Cities Symphony. Yes, there are two S's in the middle, .org. We'll see you all soon. Bye-bye now.